Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, May 9th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for another science forum on Vox Pop. Our panel of experts has been reassembled from factory correct parts to field your scientific questions. Set up your chemistry sets. Give us a call now, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that number, 800-348-2551. Oh, it's the Science Forum, and it's coming your way right after the news. Well, hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We get the Science Forum together every so often, and we bring back experts to answer your questions and comments. The number to call is 800-348-2551. If you have a science question, 1-800-348-2551. Now, you can tweet your questions and comments if you wish at WAMC Vox Pop, and our producer may or may not be looking at the Twitter feed, but hey, give it a shot. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org if you want to email. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Let's have our lovely and talented panel of scientists sign in, please.
Ooh, I'm first. It's Barbara Brabet, straight from giving two finals this morning at SUNY Cobleskill, where I teach biochemistry. And my water chemistry final was this morning, too. Oh,
anyone going to pass?
A few.
Really?
I think so. Really? Maybe if I get some sleep.
Do you have a big red pen that if they fail, you put a big
I do, X? But yeah. not to break the flow of anything, but we've heard that red is stressful, so we've been given opportunities to use other colors but red. But I'm telling you, it's probably what we write, not how we write.
But at the same time, those who are doing really well get stickers, so that's even more
smiley
important.
Faces. And that would be Ed, right?
That would be Ed, yes. And I just wanted to mention that, you know, when you were talking about experts, I actually had a very good friend once whose last name was Pert, and when she got married, she became an expert.
Oh.
And that's as close as I've ever come to an expert.
That was, thanks, Ed Stander, for that.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist. Mostly retired.
Yeah. Are you happy that you're back here with the show?
Here?
Yeah.
Sure.
Really?
Yeah.
Even sitting between these two?
Well, you know, you got to take the good with the bad.
Right? All right. Now,
now, wait a minute. Which is which?
I'm bad.
The team, I said, anything you want to discuss before the show starts? And they said, oh, yes, Jim has something, but you haven't read the article.
No, I haven't read it all. Just scanned it through.
Okay.
What is kind of interesting about it, though, is that... it's sort of making lemonade from lemons. Scientists are probing toxic waste sites for microbes that contain some very interesting compounds that could be pharmaceutically interesting.
Huh.
There's one place in particular. It's an abandoned copper mine in Montana called the Berkeley Pit.
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of good stuff has come out of that. Berkeley Pit is highly acidic and contains all sorts of nasty metals.
Yeah.
And some interesting microorganisms apparently have found that a good place to live.
It's nice that we can give evolution a little push by putting a nice acidic pile of metals together for them.
You know, humans never screw things up
no.
in the natural world.
We have the best intentions.
Yeah, exactly. You know, those copper mines are phenomenal. I remember taking a train out west when I was a kid, and I still remember going past Butte, Montana.
Huge.
And, oh, my gosh.
You don't even have scale.
Yeah.
It's so big.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the phones. 800. Enough about copper mines. Let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Science Farm. Ryan in Malta. Ryan, you're on.
Hi. I wanted to ask about a number one plastic recycling thing I'm trying to do. I have some Dow styrofoam billet that I wanted to encapsulate so that it doesn't spread and become microplastics everywhere. I wanted to reuse it. What's the cheapest way to encapsulate that?
I would say the easiest way to get rid of styrofoam is to put it in acetone myself.
But well, I'm not.
He wants to reuse it, though.
You want to reuse it, right?
I am going to use some of it on another project, dissolving it in acetone and then painting some sort of sealing up some wood with it. And I know it isn't good with UVs, but that's going to be in the basement. So that's fine. That's easy.
To encapsulate it, I would recommend shrink.
The cheapest way to encapsulate it.
Shrink wrap.
Okay, kind of like the white boat heavy plastic?
Yeah. That will encapsulate it, and that'll keep it together.
Nothing I can put directly on it, like sedimentatious with a polymer. I'd rather have a flexible polymer I paint directly on, but, it can't cut.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the problem is the solvent that you have to deliver the other polymer with is probably going to dissolve your styrofoam.
Yeah, a water-based acrylic might do it. But
okay, I give that a shot. That's a paint.
How about the roof rubber? Have you ever used that?
The roof rubber?
Yeah, there's a paintable roof rubber effectively.
Yeah, I've seen the ads on TV.
And it works very, very well. I don't know what it would do with styrofoam, but that would certainly seal
it. I think it's an ethyl acetate.
Ooh. That would
when
not be good.
When you spray it, and so you don't want ethyl acetate anywhere near styrofoam.
No, this is not a spray. This is a paint.
It dissolves the styrofoam. Yeah, okay. It's gone. It goes completely.
Right. What about stuff with toluene? Toluene would have the same effect.
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
No?
Any organic solvent, really.
Yeah, okay, it would have to be very much water-based.
I'll use plastic.
Yeah.
It's the easiest and cheapest way.
Yep, all into right. a plastic.
Because everything else is going to knock it down.
All yeah. right,
you can make as big a science experiment out of this as you want, but it really is going to come down to using something simple.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Ryan. The number here on the Science Forum is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. If you have a question for our team, let's go to Marta in Poughkeepsie. Marta, you're on.
Thanks, Ray. Hello. Thank you. Sounds like you have some interesting chemistry on the panel today.
So far.
The question is radio frequency radiation. I understand that's going up because of the G5. And I'm wondering what exactly that means. Because as far as I know, radio frequency radiation is microwaves. Can the panel comment?
I think you mean the 5G network.
5G.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Like the next cellular network?
Uh-huh.
It's similar to the others. I mean, it's really not that much different.
Not a higher rate or higher microwave?
No, it's just
they now talk about low pulse is what we're experiencing with whatever the former G was. But now this 5G seems to me it's going to be a higher frequency. Am I wrong?
It might be higher frequency, but it's mostly a wider bandwidth that they're looking at, so they can carry much more. That's the basic idea of 5G.
Is it safe for people to be around that?
Well, they're going to be, that's for sure.
I know, but that doesn't answer the question. Is it safe?
It's a matter, in the case of microwaves or of the radio waves, mm-hmm. it's a matter of intensity, mm-hmm. because the electromagnetic radiation at those wavelengths does not have enough energy to do any interesting chemistry. All it can really do is make things warm. So if you were standing right by the antenna, that might not be a good idea because there's a great deal of energy that
would warm the tissues.
It would be a microwave oven sort of effect.
Yeah.
It can warm the tissues. But out in the world, the intensity is so low that it doesn't do anything to
even if it's coming inside the house via the smart meters for gas, water, electric, or the cell phones or the Wi-Fi devices everybody's got.
Yeah.
That's still not
you get orders of magnitude more energy from the visible light in a room than you do from the radio waves that are passing through.
And radio waves are just effectively a lower frequency form of light. So there's where that comes from.
To give you just a little scientific notation perspective, gigahertz, which we're talking about for this stuff, is 10 to the 9 hertz. And the stuff like yellow light is 10 to the 14 hertz. So, you know, there's orders and orders and orders of magnitude more energy in yellow light than there is in this.
Now, it's going to hurt less.
It is true, though, that certain frequencies affect human tissue more than other frequencies.
Again,
right?
With intensity.
Right.
You have to have the intensity there.
Right.
So Yes.
I mean, 10 meters or 144 megahertz at 2 meters, something
sure.
like that.
Much of that has to do with water.
Yeah.
Okay.
So bands in which water absorbs strongly, like in a microwave oven, you don't want to encounter that at high intensity. Mm. But at low intensity, all it does is make the molecules spin a little bit.
Yeah, and we're being hit by microwaves all the time, and it's having pretty well no effect on us.
And, you know, I've been in radio for 30 years, and look how normal
There's
I am.
There's nothing wrong with
right?
you, right?
Yeah. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551, the Science Forum. Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, Barbara Brabets are here to answer your questions. We'll be right back. Vox Pop Science Forum today. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is the number. Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, Barbara Brabets are the scientists, and they'll answer your questions. This email came in, and then back to the phones we shall go. This is from our pal Nancy in Queensbury. Nancy writes, can multiple applications of sonar on a small kettle lake kill the bullfrog population? The fish are diminished, and I heard the last bullfrog last year. They used to keep my son up at night when he was little, and my heart is broken. And that's from Nancy in Queensbury.
Sonar could disrupt the egg masses.
Now, this is sonar like... It's not a chemical called sonar. Right.
No.
Okay.
I think it's not a chemical called sonar.
I don't know.
There is a chemical called sonar.
Is there?
Is there?
Yeah, that's fluorodeon.
And what would they use that for?
They use it at very, very low amounts, 40 parts per billion, for example, to kill invasive species in
Okay,
lakes.
So that's probably what Nancy's
yeah,
talking about.
Yeah, probably more than somebody's
putting sonar in a lake, putting their speakers underwater. Yeah.
And no, if you use, and I know this because I've worked with the stuff, if you use sonar at the 40 parts per billion, which is the maximum you're supposed to use it at, it has no effect. What it does is it actually disrupts the plant's ability to photosynthesize, and that's what kills it.
But people overuse it, possibly?
Well, even if you overused it, it would have very little effect. The only real danger is you'd wind up getting rid of all the plant life
right.
that
Somebody's
the animals
eat the
are living
plants,
on.
Right?
Ah, so they've gone elsewhere.
It's a food web issue.
Okay.
Yep. Right.
Our number here is 800-348-2551, and we go to Jim in Adams, Mass. Jim, you're on.
Hi. Yes, let me take off speakerphone. Yes, I have an answer for the gentleman who was calling about encapsulating styrofoam. I build theatrical scenery, and I carve foam all the time, and all different types of foam, including styrofoam. Am I allowed to say a brand name?
I suppose.
Over the air, or
as long as you don't work for them, go ahead.
In the name of science.
No. There's a product we use, and it is used for to encapsulate foam, and we do a lot of outdoor theater. And it's called Jaxan, J-A-X-A-N, and it is a water-based roof coating. It's used for sealing mobile home roofs, et cetera. It's a waterproof, but it will seal that foam. It's available in different grades, in brush grade and spray grade and whatever. And so just for anybody
cool.
who needs to encapsulate some foam, just want to throw that out there.
All right.
Thank you.
So thank you very right. much. So everybody out there who wants to encapsulate some foam, we now know the answer.
That's the stuff that I would have used. Yep.
All right. The number here is 800-348-2551. And let's see what else we're talking about today. Let's go to Eileen in Kingston. Hello.
Hello there. I also want to address the issue of wrapping styrofoam in plastic.
Yeah.
I've noticed that especially when you store plastic bags, when you store things in plastic bags, especially in an attic or in a high heat area, the plastic bags break down rapidly, flaking, you know. So a couple years later, you can go up there or wherever they're stored, and the stuff is out of the bag, and there's just debris, tiny little flakes of debris. So so that won't work.
Well, it depends.
A long-term solution.
That depends on the plastic. The plastic called polypropylene breaks down just as you say. It will be wonderfully pliable and ductile one day, and then the next day you can crumble it to dust in your hand.
Especially, and heat does that to it very rapidly,
Heat does that as well as sunlight. Polyethylene, which is more commonly used in bags, isn't as susceptible to that and doesn't tend to break down into the little crumbly flakes.
Although it does have UV properties that, unless it's protected, it don't tend to break down.
Yes, I mean it will eventually break down, but it doesn't make the crumbly bits like polypropylene does.
And you can get thicker mills of like if you went to one of the big box stores and instead of buying the kitchen bags, you bought some of the heavy duty bags for outside. That just that doubling of the thickness of the bag really does go a long way for storage and lifetime in the attic.
Number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum on WAMC Vox Pop. And Richard in Schenectady. Richard, you're on.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody there. I was wondering, you hear a lot about alternative energy sources such as solar and wind and hydro, but most all of that has to do with electricity generation. And I'm thinking, if I had electric heat, I'd be able to compare. But I'm wondering, do most people, residences at this latitude, use more fossil fuels in their use of electricity or in generating heat for their houses? Please, if you have an idea.
Well, that's a really changing dynamic because our supply in New York State, we're from our New York State delivery services, so like National Grid or Central Hudson, buy from consortia that they have agreements with. A good portion of that now tends to be these alternative energies. We don't burn coal in New York anymore for energy generation for the distribution. So that part is done. We still do generate electricity for the grid from nuclear, both in central New York and downstate a little bit.
And hydro, of course.
And then there's lots of hydro. And then Canada is trying to sell us its hydro. They've had some conservation efforts up north of the border that have been very, very fruitful. And so now Hydro-Québec in particular has a lot of capacity and not as much of a customer base as they had in the past. So they've almost got a surplus. And so they've come a-calling with cheaper prices.
In fact, we're running into problems. I shouldn't say me, but the utility companies are running into problems because they work on 10-year plans and the amount of electricity that people are using is going down. And so they're actually running into problems figuring out how to use the electricity that they
have.
Right,
but you know what the trick is? They'll always raise the rates because we're not using enough.
Well, they'll increase the delivery rates.
Yeah, that's even the better. Trick. That's how they get you.
There's one other piece I wanted to bring about electric heat. Some of my friends, environmentally friendly or just financially savvy, have switched to PVs because the price of solar panels has gone down quite considerably. Mm-hmm. And even though it's not a really efficient way to make energy in northeastern United States, you can do a good job if you time it just right. And they've actually taken out their gas dryer and put an electric dryer back in, even though the gas dryer was more efficient. Now they want to generate locally, so they put the electric dryer back in. I have friends who are actually putting in electric heat in the parts of their houses that they're adding on because they can make it locally with their PVs and they don't have to pay for it.
But they're generating the electricity and going back into the grid, or are they going directly into their own lead acid batteries or whatever kind of batteries?
They're working that any surplus they make goes into the grid. So if you time when your cycle for your PV, your solar panel contract is, so that you start just about 2 months ago, like early March, April, when the sun gets more, then you're going to make excess in the summer. Then you're going to use that excess in the fall and winter, and then you should come out even in the spring.
Oh,
so as long as you don't start your cycle in like September.
Now, what do you mean start your cycle? Cycle?
Yeah. Well, what happens is you end up with these contracts with the solar companies, and it you can't go in a deficit at any time, or you end up paying. Mm. So you have to make sure that you use your fruitful months of generation and kind of create your own local bank of electrons. It's virtual electrons. They're not real. They've already gone to the grid. But you've got that kind of in the bank, and then you can use them up in the wintertime.
Yeah, but still, you're using on the order of 20 or 30,000 BTUs. Effectively, except you're using it, of course, 30,000 watts of electricity.
Right.
So you're talking about having to have, 40 or 50 solar cells running full time in order to keep the house warm.
Well, notice I didn't say the whole house is electric. I said that their new extensions that they're building are electric. So they have conventional heat by other means, but then for their add-on, they want to keep it local, so they go electric
heat. Very interesting. All right, let's go back to the phones here at 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. John in Pattersonville is next.
Hello.
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 Hi.
Are you hearing me?
We are.
Yes.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't know if you were getting through. I just wanted to add a little bit to the discussion on encapsulating expanded polystyrene, or styrofoam as it's more commonly known. There's some interesting work done by a fellow named Ben Mosier, probably 25 years ago. I think the initial patents were dated. On using liquid waterborne phenolic resol resin to encapsulate the polystyrene, expanded polystyrene, and then curing the resin with the application of heat. Turns out it makes a very good insulation board type product, not very flexible, but not totally inflexible. The industry never took off in the U.S., but it's very big in Asia. And there's several companies in China and Australia and even New Zealand, I think, has a company that's making this type of product because it's when you encapsulate the polystyrene with the phenolic resin, it makes the polystyrene pretty much inflammable because the phenolic is so inflammable. Anyway, just thought I'd add that to the discussion.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for that. Anybody want to discuss that?
Nope.
Nope.
Moving on, 800-348-2551 on the Science Forum. David in Cambridge. David.
Good afternoon. Hi. For quality broadcasting purposes, I am speaking to you through a telephone that dates back to the Eisenhower administration, just as a public service.
Thank you.
Anyway, so the fellow was just on. When he was talking about polystyrene, I was thinking insulation. So he already took the thunder as far as that goes. There's just as an adjunct quickly, WANC covers a show called Marketplace, and the host, Kyle Risdahl, I believe his name is, National Grid, not our national grid, but England's national grid, has generated power now for the first time totally coal-free. And now, without further ado, the purpose of my call, and that's about battery technology. My niece and her husband just bought a Tesla Model 3 sedan. They let me drive it. Is it fast? Yes. Yes, it is. But I have my concerns about lithium-ion batteries being somewhat unstable. It's not often when they go, but when they do, it's quite spectacular. And so my question, because I'm too lazy to do the research, is do you people know about how goes the war in regards to battery technology for something that might be equally light and portable compared to lead acid, and yet a bit less of a bomb?
All right, panel.
Well, the electrochemistry is pretty straightforward. Lithium ion gives you a lot of bang for your buck. The periodic table is not gleaning us new elements that we can test for their electrochemical properties, so we're really stuck with what we have. But it's not always about the voltage that you're creating. It's also about how well the components can cycle. That is, that they can discharge and then be recharged and not lose that ability. Mm-hmm. And then how much, how big, the kind of the weight to electrical output ratio that we have. So there are others out there. I'm a fan of a dark horse called the zinc air battery myself, but it doesn't put out as much electricity, but it uses air.
Cool. Yeah, in the scientific literature, there is ongoing extensive research into the batteries, and you always read about the great breakthrough that's going to change everything, but they very rarely pan out. So you can never say never, but it will probably be quite a while before there's something that really replaces the lithium-ion battery.
And if it'll make you feel better, so far only, as far as Tesla's concerned, only one car is actually blown up surreptitiously on its own That was in Shanghai a couple of weeks ago. But prior to that, there have been 13 problems with cars catching fire because of lithium ion. And in all 13 cases, it happened during major accidents.
Oh, okay. I've been using lithium ion batteries for years, and I think they're a big improvement over the NiCads.
Oh, yes. Totally agree.
Less memory effect, right?
Right, that whole cycling issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
Less memory effect.
All right. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 if you have a science question for the panel today. Jerry in Plattsburgh. Jerry, you're on.
Thank you very much, and you have a great panel today. You were talking about radiation before, and it made me think about telephones, and especially the cell phone. So many people using it up to their ear. Does that radiation have any effect on the brain, the temporal lobe, or the corresponding areas?
Well, the Swedes have been studying it for years and years and years, and as of right now, at least, they still haven't come up with any health effects associated with that.
Out of an abundance of caution, they do recommend that children under the ages of 5 do not use cell phones regularly to their ear. Now, here's one benefit of the millennial culture. They're not making phone calls. It's us old farts who are making the phone calls and, you know, our brains, whatever. but it's mostly at arm's length that they're doing either their video chatting or their social media or their texting. And probably there's more health effects from the texter's thumb than there is from any health effect from the radiation penetrating the skull.
And, of course, there's also the fact that they keep on running into telephone poles.
Oh, yeah, or falling in fountains or, God forbid, crashing cars.
Every once in a while, something will pop up in the literature and the press about some study showing some effect. What you have to remember is that most of these, the cutoff for significance is 95% confidence.
Mean?
And what
that means
that means is that 1 out of 20 will be wrong.
Right.
And that seems to be about the rate at which things will pop up.
Okay.
So just the fact that people continuing to study them randomly once in a while, the statistics will be that they'll pop up with some effect, even if it's not really there.
Jerry, thank you for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. We have Ed Stander here, Jim Pickett, and Barbara Brabitz. Let's grab one more before our next break. John in Great Barrington. John, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for answering. I have a question in regards to high-tension power lines, transmission lines. I was wondering, what is a safe distance that you can live in relationship to these power lines? And the ones I'm concerned with, they're running at 115,000 volts.
That's an interesting question, because now you're talking about a duty cycle of what, 100%? It's always running, and it's always by you. So what do you guys think about that?
Yeah, well, it's also, you know, the current is steady as well. The issue with electrical magnetic fields influenced by electricity is really one of distance. And so it's a 1/r². So the further away you get, if you double the distance away, you are a quarter as influenced by it as you normally would be. So if you go, instead of double the distance, if you do 4 times the distance away, then it's 1/16 of the effect. So distance is, that's one of the reasons why they put them up high. So that they're not towards the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And the thoroughfares that they give, you can take any kind of handheld Radio Shack meter and kind of go to the bottom of those, and you'll get nothing.
Yeah, interesting.
Nothing like, just like you'd get anywhere else. So they're high enough.
Does it move and fluctuate during the day, or...
No.
Yeah.
No. So the current. It's heavy duty. You know, the flow of the transmission is the transmission, so it doesn't surge or anything like that.
Well, a lot of electrical questions today on the program. Mm-hmm. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number, and there's still time for you to get your call in. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. The Science Forum at our number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpopwamc.org. And this one came in from Ian in Saugerties. My screen door has two layers of screen mesh on it. There is little space between the two screens. It gives the visual illusion of circles and lines that move about. They bear a striking resemblance to what tree rings look like on wooden boards and cut wood, etc. Question, is there a name for this phenomenon? And given their striking resemblance to the rings of a tree, is there any connection to how trees ring form as they grow and the illusion of rings my screen door?
Well, what you're seeing.
I love this, by the way.
Yes.
Love it.
You want to say?
Well, it's called a moiré.
Moiré pattern. Yes.
Go ahead.
M-O-I-R-E.
Yeah.
It was very big.
We have to spell on the radio now?
Yeah. It's not named after Maury Amsterdam.
That's right. It was very big in the 60s when other things were also very common. But please, go on.
So you put two grids on top of each other and offset them a little bit, and you get these very interesting patterns.
Yeah.
And Barbara can correct me, but I don't think this has anything at all to do with tree rings.
No, tree rings are really just times of feast and famine in the cycle of a photosynthetic being.
And the reason you're seeing circles is because you're seeing it from your eyeball, and so you look up and look down and sideways at the same time. So you're seeing the pattern sort of rotating around or working around your center of vision.
Ah.
Yep.
So if you had a square iris, it would be square?
Or a flat eyeball.
A flat eyeball. Oh, yep. Interesting. Oh, that's fascinating. All right. Any more questions about polystyrene? Let's go to the phones. John in Great Barrington. John, you're on.
Yes, hello. I had a question for you about ultracapacitors. I read about them a while back, that they will take a charge very quickly, disperse it almost instantaneously, and they do not have a lot of wear down. Is that ever going to be a good technology for cars, et cetera?
Yeah, the ultracapacitors are good for speed. They're not so good for capacity. You just can't store a lot of electrons in there compared with other kinds of batteries.
Yeah, the idea was to use an ultracapacitor in the same way you'd use a flywheel. By getting the speed up on a flywheel and then releasing that energy, you'd wind up being able to, for example, collect your energy from a car as it's slowing down. But batteries do the same thing. Effectively, they replace the ultracapacitor idea, and they're a lot safer.
Yeah. Because the ultracapacitors will have to work at extremely high voltages. And
a little dangerous.
A little dangerous.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to ground one, that's for sure.
Number is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, and Barbara Brabitz
are
here.
Before we go on, I wanted to remind
everybody.
Oh, I forgot.
I'm so sorry. Go
ahead. It's okay. He was so into polystyrene.
Oh, yeah.
That our commencement at Sydney Cobleskill is this Saturday. And thank the weather people, Jason Goff. I'll plug for him in that we're going to have good weather.
We are?
I think so.
Okay.
That's what my phone tells me.
If we're not, you blame Jason.
I will.
Okay.
We always do.
Good.
But we are fortunate to have a recipient of an honorary degree and a guest speaker, and it is former Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. So an Iowan will be in New York.
Oh boy.
To talk to agriculture and technology students about what it's like out there in the big, bold world.
And what time does that start?
It starts at 10 o'clock because we're all outside. So we're together.
You know, Ed answered that question very quickly. You want to get this done with, don't you? You want to be done with the semester.
Oh, well, I would prefer to have other things to do, for sure.
All right. Let's go back to the phones, and we go to Rick in Kingston. Rick.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, yes. My question comment is in reference to cell phone radiation. And first, my comment about my experience that I've had in the past. When you first... The new cell phone technology came out, I started noticing effects, especially inside a car, and little twitches in my head and whatnot, and I started to get headaches with people answering and talking on the phone inside the car, and then not too long after that, I got a really bad case of Lyme disease, and ultimately found out I had elevated levels of heavy metals. And every time somebody would answer the phone inside the car, I would get pains in various places. And I found out my highest levels of metals were mercury. And so over the course of time, I did chelation therapy to remove that mercury. And then at this point, I have like very little reactivity to the cell phone energy.
Huh.
But I wanted to bring that up because, you know, some people seem to be more sensitive to EMF technology and microwave radiation. And I'm wondering if you think that the heavy metals contents inside your brain or whatnot might play a part in how somebody reacts.
I think that's a very interesting question.
Well, if I can start with that, cell phones are receivers. They're not transmitters, actually, just not high power. But very, very low power transmitters. And such, I will keep my mouth shut and let somebody else talk.
Well, I was going to ask about your chelation therapy. How long did they do your chelation therapy for?
Couple years.
And do you know what the levels of mercury were in your blood before you started?
Well, you know, it's a relative measure because the best testing that's available is a chelated challenge test that measures it in your urine, and it's kind of a proportional amount, and it gives you the relative levels of heavy metals of different types. And it gives you a level that is kind of shows you a little bit what is considered toxic and what is really more benign levels.
So if I were to like pick a duck off of a contaminated waterway, and I'm not going to compare you to a duck, but a duck gets cut up and then they can look at the tissue inside, not the blood, but the tissue. And what they find is on the order of a milligram of mercury per kilogram, 2.2 pounds of body weight. So usually the level, and that would be a toxic level for the duck. If we look at what would be in your blood, it would be far lower than what is called a part per million. And so it's difficult to think that less than 1 milligram per liter of your blood, and you've only got about 5 liters of it. So we're talking about 5 milligrams total of mercury in your blood, not just your tissue, but in your blood. That's not that much. If I had it in front of me, I probably couldn't see it.
Okay. Well, interesting question all the same. Thank you for that one. 800-348-2551 is the number here on the Science Forum. And now we go to Jim in Pittsfield. Jim.
Hi there. Want to greet Jim Pickett. This is Jim from the High Throughput Lab at CRD.
Yes, I recognize the name and address.
Uh-huh. Sure enough. Wanted to comment on your statistical thing. I'm still doing consulting in the statistical field, and a 0.05 confidence level is getting ripped to shreds in the statistical world right now.
Tell us how.
For that reason.
Yeah, I've been reading about that in Science. Yeah, do you want to expound on that a bit?
Well, first of all, the exact thing you mentioned, if you go over to a 0.05 level, you've got a 5% chance of being wrong. If you do a lot of studies, those things are pretty doggone fast. But also, they're going into entirely different kinds of considering what makes for a significant and real result. They're doing more of what's called Bayesian statistics now, which examines actually what you believed before you did the test and then comparing that to what you really got. I mean, you know, for one thing is that they're not letting people do a bunch of tests and then decide what to look for.
Yeah.
That people, you know, to get a, let's say, a passing grade in terms of a study, you need to list out up front what you are looking for and then say, well, did we find it or not?
Yeah, because if you look hard enough, you'll always find something.
Absolutely. If you select 20 sets of random numbers, one set will give you a 0.05 result.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, well, thanks, Jim.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. It's the Science Forum on WAMC, and Mark in Springfield is on. Mark.
Yeah, I got a question on road mirages. I was just driving down the road, and a car coming at me about probably a half mile away had its headlights on, and about halfway between them and me, I could see their headlights sort of like beaming out of the pavement, and I was wondering what causes that.
That's good. That's very good.
Got it.
It's that's called a heat mirage. And what happens is the road is very, very hot and the air is colder. And as a result, there actually forms a very thin layer of hot air and then cold air above
it.
It's like a temperature inversion.
Very fine.
But it's very small, and there's a line between the hot and the cold so that the light comes, hits that surface, and then bounces back down again.
Right. Not the surface of the road, but the surface of the temperature change in the air.
Yeah.
So just like a glassing surface, it will reflect.
Yes, the angle is very important.
Yeah, it has to be a very shallow angle. And in fact, it inverts the image, too.
Yep.
You can see that sometimes over water and see a ship in the distance upside down going through the air.
Yep. When Perry went to the North Pole, he discovered a land which later determined was not actually there, an island that was not there. And a lot of people discredit his getting to the North Pole as a result of that.
Ah.
But chances are what he was looking at was a mirage of an island that was much further away.
Upside down.
Upside down, yep.
Yep.
Well, Mark, thanks for the call. Now we go to another Mark, this one in Salem. You're on.
Hi, Ray. This is a question that has been bugging me nobody seems to be able to give me an answer that's satisfactory. In the late 19th century and early 20th century, there was a big battle between Edison and Westinghouse.
Tesla and Westinghouse.
DC and AC current. And we have been using AC current because it's you can use smaller wires and transmit better. And now I see that the very high voltage transmission lines, say from the Quebec, they are all DC.
Mm-hmm.
How is it possible? What can somebody explain why there's a difference? Is it strictly due to the voltage? What is going on at the electron level? I mean, for years we've always been told that AC is, you know, more efficient at transmitting power, and now it's DC that they're using for their high-tension power lines.
Go ahead, scientists.
Yeah, there's less line loss in DC power. The reason why DC was a major problem was because of the amount of copper that would be required in order to keep not have an impedance problem with the power going through the lines. We wouldn't have enough copper to do it all across the country. But when you're talking about transmission lines, they're huge. They're very, very thick. And so you don't have a great deal of loss on the edges of the wire, which you would have if it was straight DC going through a house.
And now, so I remember my college physics, which I took 4 years, that if the electrons tend to reside on the outer surface of the wire, whether it be a solid wire, that's why stranded wire was made up, because it had more surface area.
Mm-hmm.
There must be something else that they're doing. Well, are they chilling the wire? Or
No. I'm an organic chemist, not an electrical engineer. But in AC, you're flipping the direction of the electric and magnetic field 60 times a second. That means that anything which can respond to that field also gets flipped, and that causes transmission losses. So if you don't have to do that flipping, then it will be more efficient. That's one reason why the high voltage transmission wires, AC transmission wires, aren't insulated, because the insulation would suck up all the power, because it would be responding to those polarization differences and heat up.
All right.
So I think it's primarily just on the efficiency of the transmission. One thing that AC was also beneficial for is that it's easier to make junctions between the wires on AC, because one wire will induce the current into another. It's really hard to splice DC wires efficiently. And I think also the stepping up and stepping down the voltages is easier with AC than DC. There'll probably be all sorts of angry phone calls.
Well, too bad the show's almost over. Let's go to Alicia in Colbert. You're on.
Hi, Ray. This is a great show. I wanted to comment on the cheap electrical energy. The Hydro-Québec and Nalcor are trying to bring on a new dam. It's a mega dam near Happy Valley, Labrador, called the Muskrat Falls Dam. And this dam is going to have severe consequences for the Inuit and Métis people who live there. A Harvard study was done recently that looked at mercury levels. The implications are that it could destroy the traditional food system that the native people there rely on. And also, it's built on quick clay, which so there are concerns about dam collapse.
All right. Well, on that point, Alicia, we do have a geologist here, so why don't you address that?
I've actually been to Muskrat Falls. Yeah, you're right about both counts. And really, the question always comes down to, and it always has been for Canadians, because I'm also Canadian, that...
Are you? You are?
I am, yes.
Oh, be darned.
People down south want what the people up north have, and the people up north, there are too few of them to actually complain about it. And mm-hmm. that's always been the case. And unfortunately, the Indian Affairs people up in Canada don't really listen to that. Hydro-Québec is the number one and the biggest corporation in Canada, and so it becomes very difficult to fight them.
So yes, if you're an American conserve, so, then you won't need Hydro-Québec.
Yeah, that's it. If we keep using less electricity, we'll be okay.
Well, Alicia, thank you for the
call. Thank you.
Yeah, we appreciate it. That's where I guess we will have to leave it here. We have 15 seconds. Anybody have anything smart to say?
Yeah, I'll say something smart.
Wow.
If you get rid of the refrigerator in your garage that's filled with beer, then we won't have to have a Muskrat Falls.
So true.
So drink the beer.
Drink the beer.
Get rid
of the fridge. Anyway. And the electricity you save will make a big difference.
Yep.
I got to be honest with you. You had me at beer. So that's where we will leave it here today. Support comes from Careers in Transition at LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume and cover letter writing, accepting new clients. Careers in Transition, LLC.com. Interactive Media Consulting, a team of online market strategists providing websites, branding, digital marketing to the Capital Region and beyond since 1996, imediaconsult.com. And Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear, European styling, and prescription and non-prescription sunglasses. Eye exams by appointment, EYEDENTITY, eyewear, Albany.com. Thanks again to Barbara Brabitz, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett, our esteemed science panel, for stopping by today. Thank you for listening. Great calls, especially the ones about encapsulating polystyrene. And thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Zach, splendid job. One day to go. Don't screw it up. Amber Sickles, thank you for answering the calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, oh, this is great. The folks from the St. Sophia Greek Festival will be back, and we'll have some Greek food. We'll dance on the table. Stand by for the next program.